Hello, John Dennis here on Thursday, the 18th of December. Today, the Attorney General moves to crack down on direct action protests on issues such as climate change.
They were acquitted because they persuaded the jury that even though they caused damage to the power station, they were trying to protect much more serious damage that would be caused by global warming.
As the UK jobless figure tops 1 million, we hear firsthand from some of the people who found themselves out of work.
From my point of view, I'm worried about the fact that I will get one last payment, which is in January. And after that, there's nothing there.
And British troops prepare to leave southern Iraq.
We will end our mission on May the 31st, and our troops will be coming home during the next 2 months.
Guardian Daily with John Dennis on guardian.co.uk.
But first, today's news headlines with Sandy Waugh.
The government has abandoned plans to make the police more accountable to local communities through direct elections. The Police and Criminal Justice Bill to be published today was to include proposals to increase senior officers' accountability. The Home Secretary, Jackie Smith, said the decision was due to opposition from senior officers, Labour Council chiefs, and concern that the proposals would politicise forces. The Home Secretary has been facing a growing revolt from within the police and from leaders of Labour-run local governments, worried that their influence over the police would be diluted. The US carmaker Chrysler is to halt production at all 30 of its plants for a month. The company employs 46,000 union workers. Chrysler is waiting for the US government to find a way to help the car industry. A $14 billion bailout deal for the industry failed in the Senate last week, raising fears of job cuts and a possible industry collapse. People should avoid calling 999 unless it's an emergency, because ambulance services and A&E departments are struggling to cope with the winter illness season. Ambulance services in England have just had their busiest week ever. This may be due to the cold start to the winter. So far, this December has been the coldest for 30 years in many parts of Britain. Things may get worse over Christmas and New Year, with a rise in drink-related accidents adding to the problem. The alleged fraudster Bernard Madoff has been placed under house arrest. He will also be fitted with an electronic tag and will have to seek permission to leave his flat. In addition to surrendering his own passport, Mr. Madoff has also agreed to hand in that of his wife Ruth. Madoff failed to find anyone outside his family willing to sign surety for his $10 million bail. Barack Obama has said he aims to close Guantanamo Bay within 2 years of becoming president. The president-elect has told Time magazine he aims to restore the balance between US security needs and the Constitution. Outgoing Vice President Dick Cheney has said he doesn't see how the Guantanamo facility can be responsibly closed until the war on terror was over. Gordon Brown has announced troops will be out of Iraq by July 2009. Military operations will end by the 31st of May, and the remaining 4,100 forces will leave within 2 months. Around 300 members of the armed forces will remain to train the Iraqi Navy. The Prime Minister will brief MPs today on the detailed timetable for the withdrawal of troops. More on this in Guardian Daily. Quick look at this morning's papers now, and The Guardian breaks the story that Labour's been forced to ditch police election plans. The Home Secretary told The Guardian she still supported the idea of directly elected members of police authorities, but said she recognised this was the time to step back and look again. The Times reports on expansion plans at Gatwick. A potential second runway is on the table as companies plot to buy Britain's second biggest airport. The Telegraph leads on public warnings not to call on emergency services. The paper spoke to Peter Bradley, the National Director of Ambulance Services, who said the entire system was struggling to cope. The FT says the Bank of England believes the UK bailouts haven't ended. 2 months after the $37 billion bank recapitalisation, the bank believes the government will be forced to pledge more funds to the country's beleaguered financial institutions. The Independent dedicates its front page to the conflict in Iraq. The paper says an independent inquiry is needed into the causes, conflict and cost of war. More on today's stories and breaking news at guardian.co.uk.
In September, six Greenpeace activists were cleared of criminal damage to a chimney at King's North coal-fired power station. The jury was convinced that the protesters intended to protect property that may be damaged from global warming. But now the protesters face having their case referred to the Court of Appeal. Our legal affairs correspondent, Afua Hirsch, says the Attorney General, Baroness Scotland, is considering asking the courts to clamp down on high-profile direct action protests on issues like climate change.
She's considering using a power that she has under statute to seek a clarification on certain points of law that arise from a case. And in this case, she's using that power to refer the King's North case to the Court of Appeal. Now, even though the Greenpeace protesters were acquitted by the jury after the trial, she's referring the case so that the Court of Appeal can consider whether the law should be changed so that in future, protesters in similar circumstances won't be able to be acquitted by juries.
What's the motivation for this move?
It's difficult to say, but it seems that prosecuting authorities were fairly angry by the outcome of the King's North trial. It wasn't disputed that the Greenpeace protesters had invaded King's North Power Station in Kent, caused damage estimated at about £30,000 by trying to paint Gordon Binnett down the side of the chimney. But they were acquitted because they persuaded the jury that even though they caused damage to the power station, they were trying to protect much more serious damage that would be caused by global warming. Now, the prosecuting authorities apparently don't think that's a legitimate excuse for criminal damage. But because the protesters gave such compelling evidence and they had experts appearing in the trial, including one of the world's leading climate change scientists and Zach Goldsmith, who's a very well-known ecologist, and they even had a leader of an Inuit community in Greenland who gave evidence about how his communities were disappearing under rising sea levels. So because they essentially put global warming on trial before this jury, the jury were able to express their convergence with those arguments by acquitting them. And that's what the prosecuting authorities presumably are trying to avoid happening in future. They want to restrict the ability of juries to express political views by acquitting protesters.
But many people, including the jury, see these protests as legitimate. I mean, couldn't the Attorney General be accused of undermining the authority of the jury and attempting to curtail legitimate protest?
Well, I think that's a very serious issue. And what the defendants in that case are now saying is that they had their case tried by a jury who are supposed to be representative of men and women of this country. That's the whole concept of a jury system. And for the government to now try to ask the Court of Appeal to rule in a way that would interfere with that decision is arguably verging on interfering with the jury process. There's also a further question, which is the fact that the Attorney General, who's making this reference, has quite a precarious constitutional position anyway, because she is the independent supervisor of the prosecuting authorities. And in that capacity, she's made this reference to the Court of Appeal, or she hasn't made it yet, but she's considering making it. But she's also a cabinet member, and the cabinet is very divided over the issue of coal-fired power stations. And it's also arguable that this is the kind of issue that raises questions about how the Attorney General can be independent when she's part of a cabinet which is so divided over this political issue at the moment.
Afua Hirsch, and there's full coverage of that story today at guardian.co.uk/environment. Also today on The Guardian's website, the world's first air-conditioned beach in Dubai. It's possibly the world's most environmentally unfriendly beach. Read about that at guardian.co.uk/travel. Mark Lawson on how celebrity memoirs came to dominate the book market. Read about that, guardian.co.uk/books. And we name our top 100 websites of the year. Have your say at guardian.co.uk/technology. For the first time in 7 years, there are now more than 1 million people claiming jobless benefits. Official figures released yesterday show that unemployment was increasing faster than expected. In fact, faster than at any time since 1991. The number of unemployed is expected to continue to rise. Yesterday, it was announced that all Woolworths High Street stores are to shut by the 5th of January. Well, behind the statistics lie individual stories of misery, anxiety and frustration, as The Guardian's Alexandra Topping heard from people who've recently been made redundant.
My name is Jonathan Bates. I've just been redundant from a IT job, which involved me personally looking after video conferencing network problems. It was the finance industry, but we were obviously on the support side, okay. Looking after all their needs from a software point of view, from their PCs. we tried really hard in our department, and we saved them around about £400,000. And the answers they give was that they found it impossible after all the cuts they'd made that they would need to make cuts within the employees to make it beneficial for them. Having said that, this Christmas, people were given bonuses of £11,000 upwards.
Were you surprised when you found out you were going to be made
redundant? I was totally and utterly shocked. I just couldn't believe it. I was devastated, to be quite honest, purely because of the fact that they insisted and would not go back on their word to say that my job was redundant. Mm. My job wasn't redundant, and somebody else has got that job. And I think in a lot of industries throughout the UK, that's the reason why some of these people have actually gone, purely because either they're too old or their faces don't fit. Mm.
And what does this mean for you personally, for your personal financial situation?
For me, I feel quite devastated in the sense that, I'm a hard-working guy. I've worked all my life to make a nice home for my son and my wife. And from my point of view, I'm worried about the fact that I will get one last payment, which is in January. And after that, there's nothing there.
My name's Steve Rain. I've been in the automotive industry for probably the majority of my life. I was currently working for a company called Autoscan from Telford. They are automotive inspectors, and we go around the country to various factories doing inspection work and quality work. And I was currently at Bentley for the last year in their supplier quality assurance department. The factory itself there, the main workers were originally put on a 3-day week, but now because of the credit crunch, whatever you want to call it, they're now proposing when they come back after the new year that they will go back to 4 days a week. I was a contractor there, so they've laid us off early, i.e. they finish as early at Christmas, and we shouldn't be going back to there till the 12th of January. And with us being contractors, we may not be going back there anyway, because obviously if there's a glut of Bentley employees, the contractors won't be needed. So consequently, I may not be going back there in January. It's the motor industry seems to be getting really hammered at the moment, you know. My job security at MG Rover, when I joined, we had a job for life, or so we were told, you know, but that all changed.
My name's Scott Bakewell, I'm age 29, from Groby, Leicester. I'm an electrician. First of all, it was my dad that got me into it, and then secondly, the money obviously attracted me to it as well. I'd probably say about May time, I started to notice that work was kind of drying up and slowing down, and we was just ticking over till maybe August, September. And then from September onwards, it's been really quiet. You know, I've been chasing work and ringing old employees, and there's just been nothing at all. So I can tell there's, you know, definitely a recession coming or having one. I've always been busy, weekends as well, working all hours. You know, it's been quite demanding, really, but just lately, there's nothing, and it's just getting no better.
Alexandra Topping reporting. I'm John Dennis. You're listening to Guardian Daily. Still to come, Russia announces it's giving fighter jets to Lebanon as Moscow extends its influence in the Arab world.
I think what's quite intriguing about this deal, these MiG jets, which Moscow is giving Beirut are free.
But first, after one of the UK's most controversial military campaigns since the Second World War, Gordon Brown is to make a statement to the Commons today on the withdrawal of British troops from Iraq. They've been in southern Iraq for 6 years. 136 British service personnel have died there. Many more have been injured. But during a trip to Baghdad yesterday, the Prime Minister met his Iraqi counterpart, Nouri al-Maliki, and announced that by June next year, all but about 300 UK troops will have left.
We have agreed today that the mission will end no later than 31st May next year. We will, of course, continue to work in the best possible way with Iraq in the future. We will offer help with training wherever that is necessary. But having completed the four tasks that we have set ourselves, then we will end our mission on May the 31st. And our troops will be coming home during the next 2 months.
The Guardian's security editor is Richard Norton Taylor.
Gordon Brown yesterday confirmed what actually military commanders have been praying for and hoping for and expecting for many, many months. That is to say that of the 4,100 British troops which have been sort of languishing really in Basra airport for the last year or so, will start coming home early next year, some of them, and most of them, all but a few hundred, will have gone, left Iraq for good by May the 31st next year. 300 remaining will be basically training, specialist training really, of a cadet, officer cadet corps of the Iraqi army in southern Iraq, and above all really, the Navy, the Iraqi Navy, which will be sort of patrolling the waters bordering Iran, which is quite an important role, not the Shatt al-Arab waterway, for example. And the Americans will take over Basra airport. The Americans will take it over, not the Iraqis, from the British.
Gordon Brown said yesterday that British troops leave Iraq a better place. Is he right?
Yes, well, the British Army, British military commanders, including Chief of Defence Staff Jock Stirrup in today's Guardian, says that the legacy, the British Army's legacy, the British Force's legacy, in Iraq has been quite a good one. Now, they expect them to say that. They've been under a tremendous amount of criticism for two reasons. One is that they did deals with, or agreements with, the elements of the Mahdi army, that is to say the militia, the Shia militia of the radical cleric Muqtada al-Sadr, last year. The Americans didn't like this. Moreover, Maliki, the Iraqi prime minister, didn't like this either, because he didn't want anyone doing deals with his enemy, really, i.e. the Mahdi army, that sort of. And so he basically said, we've got to give up the British for a lost cause, and got the Americans in this big operation called the Charge of the Knights this spring, which was basically an American-led Iraqi operation with the British very much on the sideline. Anyhow, people were saying that the British Army has failed, they're leaving Iraq with a tail between their legs, and basically they couldn't cope, and they had to leave everything to the Americans. It's another crisis, the Americans and not the British. Now, of course, the British will say, we can't. We haven't got as many troops as the Americans, but we've left Basra, to answer your question in a long way, we've left Basra in a better place. Now, that is true up to a point, because there's much more stability there. The Iraqi forces seem to be in control, the militia are backing off. And maybe the Iran also seeing that maybe they have an interest in a more stable Basra than an unstable one. So for all these reasons, I mean, Basra is certainly in a better place.
Barack Obama is likely to ask Britain to send more troops to Afghanistan. He plans to pull US troops out, of course, in 2010 from Iraq. How is Gordon Brown likely to respond to a request from America to send more troops to Afghanistan?
It will be very difficult, but I think they'll have to do something. What Air Chief Marshal Sir Jock Stirrup has said, and said it quite clearly and publicly, is that, rather unlike the Americans, we cannot simply transfer one for one British troops in Iraq, say 4,000 or whatever, and transfer them to Afghanistan just like that. I mean, the British Army chiefs in particular have said that the tempo is far too high for the British Army to cope. Both the question of budgetary accommodation, R&R, rest and recreation, and all that, and training too, for that matter. However, the hint really, and the likelihood is, that of the 8,000 British troops now in southern Afghanistan, could be increased by what's called a battle group, about 1,500, certainly by next autumn, in time for the Afghan presidential elections, which are pretty crucial, really, and they need a lot of security on the ground. So I think it wouldn't be surprising if sometime in the spring or summer the government will announce an increase, a substantial increase of more than 1,000 extra British troops going to Afghanistan.
Richard Norton Taylor. Russia is seeking to expand its influence in the Middle East. Moscow said yesterday it was giving 10 MiG-29 fighter jets to Lebanon. Luke Harding is in Moscow for The Guardian. Luke, why is Russia giving fighter jets to Lebanon?
I think Russia, really, if we look at the big picture, is trying to regain some of the influence in the Arab world it used to enjoy in sort of Soviet times during the Cold War, when it was a kind of patron and a big arms supplier to many Arab states. If we look at what's been happening recently, Russia's been sort of gradually expanding its kind of military footprint across the region. It's done a deal with Syria to station its navy on the eastern Mediterranean. Libya's leader, Muammar Gaddafi, has just been to Moscow for talks and is going to be buying a whole load of Russian kit as well. And I think what's quite intriguing about this deal, these MiG jets, which Moscow is giving Beirut a free, they're, as you say in Russian, they're kind of bezplatny. They don't cost anything. And I think this is sort of, you know, another example of kind of military cooperation with an Arab country.
Where does Russia believe its interests lie in the Middle East?
If you actually look at who Russia is selling to, Russia is selling to pretty much everybody, really. The ideological dimension that there was, say, 25 years ago is pretty much gone. And the other thing Russia is doing is cooperating militarily with Israel. Now, rather interestingly, Moscow recently said that it's thinking about buying some Israeli drones. Now, reconnaissance drones, if it does this, this will be the first time that Russia has actually bought Western military hardware since the Second World War, when obviously that Britain and the US supplied Russia with stuff under the Lend-Lease Agreement. So there's clearly a change of thinking going on. But I think the other element is the US. The US has sort of recently done a very big arms deal to sell offensive weapons to Saudi Arabia. And in a sense, this is a kind of tit for tat. Russia's saying, well, you know, you may see this region as being, you know, a region of American influence, but that's not the case. We can do business here too.
So is Russia competing for influence in the Middle East in a peaceful way?
Yeah, well, it depends on your viewpoint. I mean, another bone of contention is that Russia appears to be in the process of selling what are known by NATO as SA-20s, which are basically sort of truck-launched anti-aircraft missiles to Iran. Now, the significance of this is that if this deal goes through and Iran has these Russian missiles, should Israel try and stage a raid on Iran to try and, say, destroy its kind of nuclear weapons program, then the Iranians will be in a position to shoot down Israeli jets. Now, obviously, Israel doesn't like this very much. But, you know, I think the Iranians would say that they're only going to use these things if of course, Israel decides to stage a raid.
And Russia's hoping to host a Middle East peace conference next year. Will it get support from the rest of the so-called quartet, the US, the EU and the UN?
Well, I think they'll be kind of lukewarm about the idea. But at the same time, you have to look at what Russia is doing. Syria's president was in Moscow recently. He wanted to try and buy some Russian Iskander missiles. Now we have this deal with Lebanon. We have growing military cooperation with Israel. I mean, it's clear that Russia is, again, a player in the region and also a kind of a sort of crucial interlocutor with Iran on the whole kind of on Iran's sort of suspected nuclear program. Russia opposes that, but supports the idea that Iran can have, you know, peaceful nuclear technology. So, you know, I think the quartet would ignore Moscow at its peril.
Luke Harding in Moscow. When the people who commission programmes at the BBC dreamt up Strictly Come Dancing, I doubt they anticipated generating quite as much excitement as it has during this series. Last weekend's voting fiasco followed a controversy over the departure of the viewers' favourite, John Sargent. The choreographer Arlene Phillips was one of the judges. The Guardian's Hannah Poole found her in unrepentant mood.
No, I'm not the queen of mean, but I do have very, very exacting standards, really high standards, and I cannot abide people that don't commit and work. In fact, it was quite unbelievable yesterday. I just did a little introduction for the Royal Variety, the four judges did, and just talking to Tom Daly, the diver, and Rebecca Adlington, the hours, the days of the week, the days of the year they work, the intensity they work, their commitment to what they are doing is just extraordinary. And there is no let up, you know. There's the Christmas day off and their training. And everything they do as well in their life fits in with the training. They never miss their training. And it's hours upon hours upon hours. And I don't, you know, we show that level of commitment if we're in sports, and that's how demanding they are. And yet, if you're demanded in dance, you're the queen of mean. You're not allowed to. It's not politically correct to demand so much of people.
Is there any sense that because of what happened with John Sargent and because he left the show sort of feeling a bit bullied, perhaps, that perhaps it doesn't really matter who wins because the viewer's favourite has left already?
Oh, it matters. To me, it matters a lot who wins. But, you know, you can't look back and imagine what might have happened. And we've had those viewer's favourites. And even if he'd have been there in the final, it may have been different with John Sargent somehow. In my heart of hearts, I doubt it.
Today, though, you're one of the very, very few women over 40 on our TV screens. How do you think the industry treats women?
I really believe in there being older women on television. I really strongly believe it. And, you know, most of my fan mail comes from young people. My fan mail comes from women, the large part. But a huge amount of my fan mail is from young girls from 6 to 16, you know, who are just in love with dance. And it's quite surprising, and so many of them, you know, some want me to be their mum, some wish I was their grandmother, I get the loveliest emails.
Arlene Phillips talking to Hannah Poole. Today's edition of Guardian Daily was produced by Phil Maynard and Francesca Panetta, and in The Guardian's new Shiny HQ by Ian Chambers. My name's John Dennis, thanks for listening.